Oh, Thunderclay. I welcome you to Radio Wolf. I'm really glad to be able to speak again. And as this time we are also basically sending this on Radio Wolf, I want to kind of introduce you also to the audience of Radio Wolf. Maybe you want to say some words of what your work is about? I mean, I know a little bit, but I'm curious to maybe see more nuances of what your work is. I know it. I know you from the so-called our corner of the internet.
That's
You are one of the representatives, and I think a growing number of people also interested in find out this so-called our corner. And
right.
maybe you want to say more.
So thank you. Thanks for the opportunity. I'm a third generation pastor in the Christian Reformed Church of North America, which is a Dutch Calvinist denomination that separated. There are a lot of splits in the Dutch Calvinists, kind of split off in the 19th century. And I've been pastoring in Sacramento, California for about 25 years. About 5 years ago, I discovered the work of Jordan Peterson. I started making videos, just basically talking about my thoughts with it. And then people started to watch my videos and they wanted to have conversations with me, and I'm very comfortable with that. Being that a lot of pastoral work is just conversations with people. So I started doing conversations with people on the internet and then started sharing some of those on the channel. And that grew into a community of sorts that sometimes we talk about as this little corner of the internet. And I began, I've started, found Jordan Peterson work, Jordan Peterson first, and then Jonathan Peugeot and John Vervaeke. And so the three of us did a number of conversations and have done a number of events together. And a lot of this has been an opportunity to talk about what it seems, even in the church, people have a difficult time talking about, which is their life, how it connects with bigger things. Bigger picture items, and just sort of a free space where people can explore, unlike church that has a obviously a confessional container of sorts. Our conversations are very open. People of no faith, people of different faiths, just a chance for people to explore and be honest and share. And I think that's been the key. There's a real longing for people to have an open space to explore what they think and have, I think, a supporting group of people around. Now, supporting doesn't mean that everybody always just agrees, but rather disagreement can be productive and honest and doesn't have to have a lot of acrimony or contention around it. So that's kind of what's developed. So for the last 5 years, both online and then in spaces like we're going to have with the festival, the Breakwater Festival in Germany, just getting people together, share their thoughts about what's most meaningful, about what's ultimate, and see where it goes.
I mean, as the name, if you can call it a name, says, our little corner of the internet, it's very obvious that there are many corners in the internet.
Yes.
And I'm curious, from your perspective, what is this corner about? What constitutes the corner that it comes home to people? And what is this homing focused on?
I think a lot of it has revolved around for religious people, it's a way of processing their perhaps sometimes their disappointments. And for people who aren't necessarily religious, it's sometimes a way of rediscovering what the religions have. And so you have someone like Jordan Peterson, who I think has been moving closer and closer to Christianity. You've got Jonathan Peugeot, who went from an evangelical to orthodoxy. And you've got John Vervaeke, who's been wondering what kind of ecology of practices is necessary for people who find legacy religions, as he calls them, unbelievable. Mm-hmm. And what's unusual in this space is that all of us, even with the different directions we're going in, can still sort of compare notes. And there's a sense of ownership that people have had. I think because, again, at least on my channel, we've had a big priority of having a space where people can share their stories. Mm-hmm. So you don't just know the celebrities online. You get a chance to know some of the randos, the regulars who can come in. And for me, as a minister in a Protestant church, I think Protestantism has always had a high value on the communion of the saints and on the priesthood of all believers. And so I think that there's something very priesthood of all believers in that practice, irregardless of where people are actually sitting with respect to the legacy religions. Mm-hmm. And so people feel a sense of belonging and ownership. And I think the belonging is absolutely at the center. They feel like this is some place where they belong, even if they are members of a church. I've had a number of people say, I feel more like I belong here than I necessarily do in my local church. And so then they ponder that, but yet they still go to their local church. So,
I mean, it's obvious that something is happening to human culture just because of the internet. There is a certain culture that you can call YouTube culture, where all of a sudden it's easy, like we do right now, people from the other side of the globe have the opportunity to talk to each other with something that both respond to and have people around a channel, a podcast, where people find it interesting what the topic of these conversations are about. And there are all kinds of conversations, but this kind of conversation that this corner, this little corner of the internet seems to be about, at least to my understanding, but also my attraction is this combination of openness, an undogmatic relationship to each other, but at the same time, a shared sense of depth that you can call spiritual, religious, or here it gets interesting because it doesn't really matter so much how you call it. It's more important that there's a resonance in what we are talking about. But there's something in the culture where this conversation seems to be called for. And it seems that this forum of the YouTube channel is a place where this starts to live. And we don't really know what it is. But it's happening, and we are finding out what it is. Would you agree with that?
Very much. I think that's a good way to describe it. And there's some excitement in that process of discovery. And part of the excitement is because there's also some uncertainty. At least for someone like myself, who obviously has commitments and accountability within a church tradition, it's... You know, to figure out where are the boundaries, how can we, and I think that's been very important for non-church people to see, to watch church people sort of, not just sort of break boundaries, but explore boundaries. And that's something that I see when people want to get into community, because there's a great deal of loneliness out there. And communities are created by boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
And so these boundary exploration is absolutely essential to this process.
When you say boundary experience, what is the boundary experience in this YouTube culture?
So YouTube is in some ways, YouTube is in some ways very open.
Uh-huh.
Of course, there are politicized, high profile culture war things like going on with Russell Brand now and have been with a bunch of different people. Right now in our culture, there's a big conversation about boundaries and limits and where they should be. And basically, a rightful understanding that boundaries are necessary and healthy, but the also an acknowledgement that we don't quite know where they are, where the healthy boundaries are. And so a lot of the culture war, I think, is being fought about these boundary questions. Should Russell Brand be monetized or on YouTube given these allegations, which are very believable given the life that he led, about his past? Because in a sense, people on YouTube, people on these screens are sort of the new priests of the culture.
Mm-hmm.
And so then you have this question, what qualifies and disqualifies for the priesthood? And we've had this with musicians, we've had this with politicians, but now, because YouTube, anybody with a Gmail address can get a YouTube channel. And then from that point, it's just your ability to capture attention and hold attention. But is anything and everything that captures and holds attention healthy for us as a culture and as individuals? So I think a lot of that is beneath many of these conflicts. And I think in this little corner, there hasn't been sort of a naming of the boundaries. This is the box that you must fit into. But there's been much more of sort of an implicit discovery and a recognition of them. So people say, well, that's more it than this. And so then when it comes to participation, how do I act when I come into this space? To be just a boundarylessly affirming, that doesn't feel right, because we have a sense that that's not serious. There needs to be formation and substance. But if the boundaries are over rigid, then there's too much exclusion and it becomes implausible. So I think that's really what the community is wrestling with.
And there seems to be something like a self-organizing principle that comes out of the dialogical process itself, because obviously hardly anyone of the people talking to each other are kind of related to each other in an organizational way.
Right.
Which is different than it used to be over centuries, where you have family relationship and then you have kind of organizational relationship, maybe professional or faith based or whatever, but not this kind of, because all of a sudden you, as you said, you can talk to everyone also in this form with a Gmail address. The boundaries are much more about the appreciation of something that is possible in this space. And part of the attraction for me for this corner of the internet is also a certain quality of dialogue, where, however you want to call it, people are able, with their staying with their authenticity and their standpoint, to explore common ground. And where this culture of exploring common ground seems to be part of what the foundation is of doing this. And I mean, the Jordan Peterson explosion on the internet had to do, as far as I see it, also, of course, with his exploration of what you could call the mythological faith reality of reality, but it had also to do with a certain dialogical attitude. And I learned particular about John Verveke, when people said what John is doing is very much related to what you do with your dialogical work, and then I kind of came about his awakening from the meaning crisis, and that basically hooked me also, because I was just very amazed of what he was able to bring to the table here. And all of them, in different ways, have a relationship to the depth of the human experience that usually is connotized by the spiritual and religious. And there seems to be a renaissance of something that is not just fundamentalist kind of a renaissance, something very different in my perception. And I see your role also very interesting, because most of these actors are not officially related to one faith in that sense.
Yeah.
You are, and if you allow me, I would like to ask you, being rooted in a faith community, by being home now in this open space of this corner, how do you see the interplay between both roles that you are living, or both identities, or maybe it's the same identity, just two parts of what you're doing there?
I see them as connected because of some of my longing in my faith community. Christianity is a proselytizing religion, and so Christianity always seeks to make Christians out of non-Christians. And in many ways, there's a sort of offense that is taken by that, and understandably so. But I have always seen my rootedness as a gift. There certainly are, again, the whole question about boundaries. Boundaries are things that we must have. I mean, if we didn't have skin on our bodies, we would be a, you know, pile of bones and gush on the floor. Skin holds us together. Skin limits. It's like all these things, there's two sides to it. And I have always worked in communities that are distressed in North America in one way or another. The dog has a way of knowing that I'm not going to do anything. And so she's digging up the garden. So I was raised in a, you know, my father was a minister, my grandfather was a minister, and I knew people for whom those realities were difficult, but for me, they never were. And so I saw the gift of the rootedness as a blessing. My father's church was very much a countercultural church. African Americans, some young people that were sort of, let's say, on the fringe of the hippie movement, and a real coming together in the 60s and 70s, exploring whether African Americans and white Americans could actually produce a faith community together. And so part of what I think someone who is deeply rooted like myself has an obligation to do is to share the blessings of those roots with others, and to try to make them available. Now, that's a sensitive conversation, in that I don't think there should be any manipulation or tyranny or coercion to that.
Mm-hmm.
Yet, there is a sense that any rooted community has, by its nature, limitation and boundaries and definition. So my challenge has been to try to share what I can by making things available to the degree that I can for people who haven't had the formation that I have.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also a recognition that specifics are specifics. My upbringing was very unique, even in my own tradition, because our congregation was not typical of the tradition. It was an estuary. It was a boundary water.
Mm-hmm.
It was a place where Dutch Reformed people and African Americans and people from various different backgrounds could sort of come together and explore. And so, as a minister, then, I always longed for that dynamic in my church space. And to a degree, we very much have had it. My congregation is extraordinarily ethnically diverse, socioeconomically diverse, educationally diverse. I mean, we've had PhDs and people who were illiterate. We've had millionaires and people who, you know, are homeless. We've had very sane, healthy people and unmedicated schizophrenics. So this kind of situation is not new to me. What was new is using the internet to try to see what level of community could be created through the internet. And then as my own little church declines and dies, which it has been doing for a number of years, asking, okay, for especially the 20s and 30 somethings that are in our local estuary group, what do they need? What can I share? What will they come to? And the same is practiced online. What do people need? What will they share? What will they pay attention to?
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I've also believed that, and I saw this in my father. I think being deeply rooted means that you can be more secure in exploring because you know who you are finally. Mm-hmm. And when you explore, you always take something of another into yourself. And whenever you do that, there's the question, will I get lost? Will I lose myself in that? And I think the more being deeply rooted means I can take more in because I'm not going to lose myself. I know who I am. And when I look at, in some ways, I'm a lot like my father in this, who had an extraordinary capacity to meet people where they were at and to never lose himself. And so if I can model that, I think that's helpful because in many ways, modeling is probably the biggest contribution that we can make.
What I find very interesting, being myself not connected to any kind of faith tradition, my experience to talk to someone like you in that sense, very powerful, because the experience is always, I don't only talk to you, I talk to a whole tradition. It's literally a different human experience. And I think it doesn't take away from honoring the individuality of the other. in contrast, it is honoring the embeddedness of the individuality of the other. But there is something showing up where who we are is not just basically my this individual little kind of dot of reality, but this dot of reality is part and parcel of something that's a living reality that has roots over the centuries in that. And in that sense, because I'm very interested, as we talked about in the last conversation, about spirituality in the open society, where all different faiths are with each other, but to be with each other, you also have to be yourself. You cannot be with other if you're not yourself at the same time. And to honor that there are kind of, let's call it this way, wisdom bodies that have established themselves over centuries, and that they talk to us, and they, that I don't feel necessarily that people kind of want me to being part of their church or something like that. That's not my experience. But people who want to honor their particular stance, they live their human depth life from. And I see here a very interesting coming together of traditions and the openness of the world manifested in something like YouTube, where traditions play a role. And I'm curious if you experience yourself in this way. I try to describe it from the other side, so to say.
Yes. So if you look at the conversations that Jonathan Peugeot and John Vervaeke have been having when they get together, a big topic of conversation has been the reality of let's call them extended bodies.
Uh-huh.
We can call them principalities and powers. We can call them, it's the spiritual reality of a tradition conceived of personally. And when I say personally, I don't mean individually. I mean as, in a sense, a person. And this way of thinking, this way of conceptualization was to a great degree destroyed by modernity, because mm-hmm. modernity, as it developed, began to say that the only discernible persons in reality are human beings. There are no persons above, there are no persons below, just human beings. And what I think when I hear you describe a tradition, in a sense, part of what you can engage with when you talk to me is you get a chance to speak to a tradition, which is a collective person, a collective body. And I think as modernity recedes, the next thing we are going to see is that we have to increasingly recognize what in the ancient world were spiritual realities,
mm-hmm.
The spirits that we participate in, spirits that have personhood and act through us in the world. This is what we're deeply interested in, because we're increasingly forced to realize that most often when we talk to people, we are really engaging other spirits that are working through the person. And so the principality of the Christian Reformed Church, that now I don't embody the whole thing, I couldn't, because again, it's a collective, but you can, in a sense, engage with that spirit through me, because I am an embodiment of it. I'm particular, I'm unique, I'm an individual, all of that is true. And so what I think part of the interest we're going to see for people is when individuals don't find themselves rooted in a principality of such, they realize that they, in many ways, are subject to many different spirits passing through the world. And there's a desire for people. John Verveke at our last conference was talking about domicide. And I think actually domicide very much connects with a home is participation in a spiritual community. Mm-hmm. And of course, this scales like Russian nesting dolls. But we sense that we are participating in larger things. And if in fact we can do so from within a community, there's a higher level of participation that can be afforded. And so I think I think in sort of the acid wash of modernity that sort of destroyed many of these very old principalities and personalities and spirit and collective spirits, there's now a new longing for people to participate. And that's why you see people going to Star Wars movies dressed like a Jedi, dressing up like Harry Potter, wishing to live in Middle Earth, because modernity has so flattened and impersonalized everything. People long once again to participate in a spiritual person and a spiritual body that is far older, one that will survive past their own physical death. And I think that's what we're seeing in the world right now. And so I think for many people, this little corner is a little stepping stool where they can kind of take a step up and look around and say, oh, I'm beginning to see these embodied spirits as traditions in the world. And because this isn't something you just decide to do one day, mm-hmm. it's something that you grow into as those spirits and those communities take you in.
If you allow me to hone in on that, because I think what you're pointing to is quite a significant, a particular cosmology that you're talking from, but that you didn't make as explicit. Basically, the way I hear you is a different understanding of our individuality. It's not I meet with you and basically the touch point is my individuality alone. You used again and again the word participation, and the way you described it, basically that there are kind of, you can call them spirits that have manifested in traditions or in other contexts as more than individual forces that we can participate in. When you look at that, that's a very different view on reality that our hyper-individualistic modern and postmodern point of view does not support. So it seems there's something, and maybe this is part of what the attraction of this corner is and what the stepping stone is that you were just pointing to, that there's a reoccurrence of recognition that we are part of higher forces, however you want to explain it. You can put them in religious terms, you can put them in spiritual or in psychological terms, but there is something that is beyond us and that we are participating in, and it's a different way of coming together when we acknowledge that.
Yes, yes, very much so. And we struggle, we have lost the language for this, and it's not just the language or the words. Uh-huh. We've lost what the words were connected to. And we don't have, you know, Charles Taylor talks about the imaginary. We don't, Verveke talks about the imaginal. We don't have the imaginary to sort of be able to point to this and everybody with some degree of credibility see what we see.
Mm-hmm.
We can see it in religious traditions still. And you could sort of see it in fandoms like Harry Potter and Lord of the Rings and Star Wars. But it's very difficult for people to see, even though they participate and act without the words or even the consciousness of what they're doing.
Isn't it that this kind of discovery of the imaginal is something that this is a big part of what's going on? Because our modernist perspective of reality is kind of a certain reality that basically, in the end, out of our scientific worldview, if you cannot basically put it into numbers, it doesn't really hold reality. And also to honor the scientific reality, it has its place, but to also acknowledge that even to talk about that, we are moving in a perspective that holds images of reality. And this even the whole scientific point of view holds that. To use the word point of view is an image. So we all of a sudden, something shows up that we are already in something that is much more the symbolic perception of reality than our usual materialistic worldview holds. And it seems part of what is needed, because this kind of materialistic worldview is also part, at least I would claim, and others do, what our problems creates, the climate crisis and everything else, that to have a reality where we see the dimension that we see in this imaginary participation that really allows us to find a deeper depth to reality than we usually do.
When we gather together in Germany, in a sense, what we will create and participate in, because it comes from below and it comes from above,
mm-hmm.
will be, in a sense, there'll be a spirit of that conference that we participate in.
Uh-huh.
That language is easy for us because we can talk about the spirit of that conference. Now, as we're having these conversations, we're already sort of forming that spirit. That spirit's already coming together. And again, what I bring to it, what you bring to it, what the other speakers will bring to it, and what the participants will bring to it, all of that will come together in a spirit. And that spirit we will participate in that. We will instantiate it. It will be, you know, there'll be boundary moments. There'll be times when something sort of seems to violate the spirit, and then people come back to the center. There'll be times when sort of the spirit gets expanded because it gets pushed. And, you know, the truth is that we human beings long for good spiritual experiences in that way. I mean, we will travel across the globe. We will pay money. We will give our time. We're looking for something, and we will create something. And after we've created it, and after the conference ends, we will remember it, and we will remember the spirit of it. And mm-hmm. we will remember the individual participations in it. And so, you know, if we have one small enough like that, we've still got the imaginary to look at that and identify it and recognize it. And almost anybody will be able to do that still today. What we're struggling with is to, in some ways, get to the next level of that. And in many ways, I think that's sort of what this little corner has become, because there have now been series of events And nobody can see all the conversations. Nobody can go to all of the events, but all of this seems to have the same spirit that it's participating in. And so then we find ourselves in that spirit. And then we play roles and participate in that spirit. And, you know, when you look at ancient religious traditions, those are massive compared to what we're doing now. What we're doing now is tiny. But there's a sense of it's a beginning, and it's participating in far larger things too, as people come into the little estuary space with what they take from these much larger spirits and traditions.
But what you're saying is very exciting, because to point it out, when we talked about imaginary, when you're describing the spirit of the conference, you were already doing exactly that. Because what is the spirit of a conference? Nobody can point it out, but I would guess every single one knows what we are talking about somewhere.
Yes.
And only because we use the wording spirit of the conference, we are able to talk about it or something like that. You can find a different word, but something that holds that. You're bringing in the experience of there is a spirit in these conferences that people can experience together, creates already a shared reality that we can talk about as we do in the very moment. And then the next step that you did is that's the easy step. And I tend to agree, because I think everyone would agree that when you're in a kind of a conference, you have a kind of a spirit, and when you have some sensitivity, you know what you're talking about to a degree. But there seems to be an organic process of all these processes that's going on that wants to kind of come together, although they don't know each other. There is a kind of a spirit of unification of all this that you again called a spirit. And interesting, listening to you, I don't know exactly what Paul is talking about. I have some sense of a possibility what you maybe are talking about, but just you pointing to that allows, at least in my perception, to grow an understanding of what this maybe means. And I can see the possibility, if we do this together long enough, something will grow that has the same clarity like the spirit of the conference, and create something that I can imagine all the faith communities had their own kind of spiritual body. This will be different, but it grows out of the dialogical process that we are in. And it seems that the conference in Mannheim is exactly for that purpose.
Yes, yes, yes. Oh, that's exactly right. And what's interesting about this is none of us control this. All of us have aspirations that will be unmet and some met. And none of us can predict everything that will happen. Things will happen at the conference that will be surprises. Things will happen that will be disappointments. Things that will happen that we cannot anticipate. A number of things we do anticipate. And so that's where we very much get the sense of it's a living spirit. But it's a living spirit that we participate in. None of us control it. And it grows between us, and it becomes its own thing. None of us own it. People can do damage to it, but it's probably fairly robust. In other words, there'll be self-correction within it. If someone sort of violates it, there'll be others that sort of push back and bring them back in. And you know, this is a reality that is beyond all of us, that we see and can point to and can participate in, and that we are still also in some ways subject to. And I think the increase the availability of that for people is what is bringing them in. They're, you know, we're still struggling with the language, and the purpose of the language is to be able to give people an image of it so they can see it. Because of course, the better they can see it, the more intentional they can participate in it and play with it, with that sort of productive play that Verveke talks about. Mm-hmm. But that's, you know, I think that's really what we're doing. And there's a real excitement about that.
Yeah. And interesting, not only that I really can go with you in your description of the possibility, and I can go with you with the perception of the vagueness. There is a possibility, and there is no certainty in that. But there is a reality in what's possible in coming together, and to bring it down to maybe a smaller unit. I experienced something similar in a smaller scale, also happening in this conversation right now that we are having. Which we also, it's just the two of us, are participating. It's also in context of an embeddedness to this little corner of the internet, to the conference in Mannheim, all that. We haven't talked before what we want to talk about. It is emerging between us, but there is an organic reality where something is emerging that is meaningful, at least it seems to me, meaningful, that comes out of a shared participation and has its own kind of aliveness that only also really can live on if I pay attention. So if I basically forget about this conversation, the conversation breaks down. Yes. But as long as I'm with you and there's a resonance field and a resonance of meaning, something is alive. And one can see that something similar in a bigger context can happen in a conference like this.
Yes, yes. Yep. And we, the truth is, we do this every day.
Yeah.
There's a spirit of a team at work. There's a spirit in a church. There's a spirit in a committee. There's a spirit in a marriage. There's a spirit in a family. And we have little awareness of it. And I think perhaps, as is so often the case, we become aware of things when we start losing them. Mm-hmm. And I think in this day of loneliness, in the West, increasingly people are living in smaller and smaller households, mm-hmm. To the point that more people are living alone than ever before. And Guy Sengstock in the last of the After Socrates videos has a wonderful description of the way that for you and I to come and have this conversation, there's risk involved. There's nuisance involved. I mean, I've got this dog to watch, and we're talking on Zoom, which is only two-dimensional, and it's there's anxiety because I might say something wrong, or in some ways, Zoom is a little more safe because with any individual personal interaction, there's always a degree of danger. Now, what this great spirit of civilization says is, here are some shared rules. There's not going to be violence. There's not going to be inappropriate touching we have all of these rules that we live out. And so here on Zoom, it's a little easier. If you say something mean, I can hit a button and boof, it goes away. But so in terms of real relationships, there's all of this anxiety and risk that for the most part we manage, but there's always the risk out there. And so even in a conversation like this, can we both find common ground, which we want for our safety, but will there also be will there also be enough difference? Peterson, of course, talks about chaos and order. Will the blend of chaos and order be exactly right so that there's meaningful interest between us? And it's in all of that sort of the spirit forms and develops the spirit of this conversation, mm-hmm. which now this is sort of our third conversation. So these little spirits come together to form sort of the spirit of our relationship, mm-hmm. which of course, when we meet in Germany face to face in that context, that then will grow. Mm-hmm. And the truth is that we're, you know, the spiritual world has so much more multiplicity than the physical world, even though the physical world has many, many layers of multiplicity. So, I mean, and this is what we're increasingly aware of or conscious of.
Yeah.
And, you know, with intentionality and consciousness, there's always the possibility of agency. And with agency, there's possibility and potentiality. And I think it's for that reason that we're pursuing this.
Mm-hmm. You said something in the beginning of your last statement that we're doing this all the time. And I would agree with that, and it would add to that, but we are not thinking this way all the time, and that is important.
Right.
The way you are describing what you were describing right now, and you again use the word the spirit, a spirit of a conversation, a spirit of a conference, the spirit, and you were highlighting kind of our embeddedness in, if I may so, bigger forces, even bigger forces in this conversation, because there's something between us that's bigger than me, at least in this, is not the way we are usually reflecting ourselves. And this has to do with our modernist cultures, where any kind of dialogue, basically, I perceive myself as the doer of this, meeting the other doer of this. And it is this kind of perception that blinds me to the embeddedness of the forces involved, because I reduce everything to my isolated agency. And there may be, has definitely a part of it, but it's not all of it. And it's important to see beyond this way of framing of reality, so to this other part of reality, which is the spiritual reality, becomes visible again.
Yes, yes.
And in that also, this kind of practices that you're suggesting become important, because they are the learning field.
Yes.
Also to change our language.
Yes, yes. No, that's exactly, and that's why we're excited about it. And it's, you know, it's not unlike an infant. If you, I have five children, and so I watch them all grow up. You know, when they're very, very young, when they're an infant, you know, they're, you know, the hands in the mouth, and they don't even know how to use their hands. But then, you know, very slowly, they're not conscious of it, spending all this time learning that I can control my hand, and they have agency over their hand.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're doing, you know, what we're looking for this, oh, okay, now we're discovering these spirits. Okay, what's my agency in this spiritual realm? And once I discover my agency, and I discover its limits, because I'll have limited agency. And then even in just a conversation with two people like this, I have limited agency, because you have agency too. And so there's negotiation and there's all of this, but because we long to grow in agency and, you know, have participation, and that moves towards ideals. I mean, that's what we find deeply meaningful in us.
Powerful. As we're also coming to the end of our time, the conference in Mannheim, do you know the dates per heart?
It ends on the 29th. I think it's the 27th, 28th, and 29th of October.
Exactly. In Mannheim, in Germany. And I put also in the description the link to the festival so that you can sign up there. And the whole idea is at least from my perspective, a continuation of this conversation that we are having right now.
Yes.
With a lot of more other people in the same spirit.
Yes, yes. And that's what is exciting about larger spirits, because these other people have already been participating in this spirit of the corner, and they now will come in. And so they already have agency from that participation. And so, you know, the agency continues to level up.
Well, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you, Thomas. Looking forward to it. Let me know. Send me a link when you...